Yeah, thank you. I got a very warm welcome, and I'm very happy to be with you tonight. For those who don't know, I'm Shoho, and Kokyo's partner, and I have been in Asia, specifically in Nepal, for the last 8-9 months. And I've been studying Buddhism over there, and now I'm back, and I'm really happy and glad. I want to share so many things with you, but unfortunately I'm so jet lagged that I haven't been able to put any structure to my thoughts. So first of all, I want to know if you hear me clearly enough back there. And then I want to share with you what I thought we could do given the situation. Maybe I just share with you some initial thoughts I'm having and what I learned. And then I ask you questions and you ask me questions. You just ask us questions, both sides, and then just unfold what comes out of it. So maybe that way you can help me basically find my way and meet you to in your need and your wish of why you came here today. So given that this is a Buddhist context, the very basis is like Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so my thoughts are that like the Buddha, that we like the initial thought mostly with Buddha seems to be this smiling person, you know. But generally speaking, Buddha is like the vacant state. I mean, what can one do with Sanskrit words, right? So Buddha, the vacant state is a mind state. And Dharma is the teaching that explains the causes and conditions for this state. While Buddha is not a conditioned state itself, in order to realize this state, there are causes and conditions that help realize Buddhahood. So that's my explanation tonight. And then Sangha is also the cause for Buddha. So there's Buddha, the vacant state in our own mind. And then there's Dharma, which is the teaching of causes and conditions. And Sangha that are the causes and conditions, so to speak, for the vacant state. Are we still on the same page? Just checking because I don't know myself. So there are so many, over the 2,500 years, so many Dharma teachings that have been explained to be just a response to many, many different beings' capacities. So they're low capacities, medium capacities, and sharp capacities of beings. Basically saying, if you are shown something, do you see it right away, or does it take you a while to see it? That's all it says. Just some people just say, they get it right away, or some people just takes longer. It's not a value judgment. It's just how people's mind work. You know, and like so for some people in the morning, they may be low capacity, in the evening they're sharp. I mean, it's really just conditions. It's not a value judgment. But out of that, you know, all these teachings have certain impact. And for example, to say that there's a vehicle that's the foundational vehicle, and then the vehicle that's a Mahayana vehicle, the Bodhisattva vehicle, and then the Tantric vehicle are also just three different versions that are, you know, said to respond to these three capacities. And yet on the other side, all the three vehicles have the same result, which is awakening. Are we still on the same page? Yeah.
What was the word you used? They have the same
Result. Which is awakening.
But not necessarily Buddha.
No, not necessarily Buddhahood. Buddhahood, but awakening, which is, you can make your own difference. And the interesting thing is, I find that depending on, you know, how much you put into yourself into an activity, the more you get a result out of it. I don't know if you experience that. Like, the more you study a recipe and then you cook something, the more confident you will be about the taste. You will still definitely be surprised about the taste, but you are more familiar with it and you know more how to work with it, you know, whatever the result is. So, like I said, Buddha, the state of Buddhahood is not a conditioned taste or whatever that comes out of your work, but it's kind of interesting, the more, just the analogy is for, like, the more you give yourself into an activity, the more something comes back. Like, it's kind of this cause and effect. The more you engage and set priority on an activity to, like, figure out that certain recipe or to do a certain exercise program, the more you engage with it, the more you receive a result. And I think you notice that a lot by yourself and your activities. And so, in my classes, in a lot of my classes, in school we went through some lot of technical Dharma teachings this year. It's called Abhidharma, and I keep hearing that many founders of our school and other schools have been engaging this material, and each time I've been opening these books myself, you only see lists, you know, various lists of things, and it's very off-putting. It's like reading a manual, you know, description manual of how something works, except that it's your mind, you know, it's like a description manual of your mind. But, you know, I look every day at my mind, you look every day at your mind, and sometimes it's like, you know, sometimes you see the structure and sometimes not, but it's not that it's necessarily always one carved thing. It keeps evolving and changing. So how come they, like 2,500 years, made this chart that seemed to be pretty standard? So that always had alienated me a little bit with trying to deal with this material. And but now I see that it's like the context. It's not that, like, of course we are all very individual and everybody of us has a different mind and works and responds differently to objects. But, like, to reach that state that's not conditioned, you got to know the basic implants that lead to that realization of Buddhahood. It's good to know certain elements of your mind. And it sounded like what the Buddha said, that these elements are all the same for all of us. And it has to do with the teachings. So we could, like, summarize the teachings of everything that helps to the development of that awakened state and how that awakened state looks like. That's basically all the Dharma teachings. And we're concentrating on, you know, seems like we have a mixture most of the time of these two, but most of the time we concentrate on how we develop the state of awakening, and then sometimes we look into the qualities, like when we do our meal chant, we recite the qualities of Buddha. Questions? Do you have any questions? Yeah.
I wonder wonder, I have been wondering for years, like about this, any Dharma teachings, Abhidharma, you know, and the complex explanation of the mind, or any Dharma teachings, and whether, I mean, would you say then that studying those teachings is necessary for reaching an awakened state?
Definitely. I want to also say why. So, like I said, the Buddha's awakened state is a state that's not conditioned. Somehow, but we are constantly seeing things that are conditioned and we focus on them. And we are even making it our main task throughout the day to manipulate anything that we see and hear and think. So we are these strategizers that are constantly studying our object and then trying to use it for our purpose, because that's how we survive. So that's just a habit and it's fine, we need it. We wouldn't do our job. And it's beautiful, because then this dance comes out of causes and conditions, and it's so gorgeous and it works. However, there's a side product that we are really suffering if things don't come about the way we want to be. And then, because of the suffering, and also because of this clinging, we constantly just miss that everything is happening in this unconditioned space of the true nature of things. And so in order to understand that, we heard the teachings and it does sound like, I mean, we can agree that nobody would be here or, even having taken refuge or taking the precepts, if you wouldn't have heard of it. So there is already a certain condition of engaging the path of true awakening that's based on the fact that you have heard about it. So because you heard about awakening, you thought about it and you pondered it, and then you said, oh, that sounds better than the other path I did, so I'm going to choose that, I'm going to try it. That was already like a sense of study right there.
What about other traditions?
What do you mean other traditions? Christianity?
Christianity, Islam. I mean, it seems to me that there are awakened beings. So I have this question about the Dharma.
Right. Well, they gotta have differentiate. So we're dialing in into subtler details. And they define what awakening is. For example, one definition of awakening that's said in Buddhism it's not only that it's unconditioned, but it's clearly aware and it's the end of all self-clinging. So we have to explore if Christianity, has the same qualities. I haven't even heard that talk about the state of awakening so far. So I'm not sure. I don't even know sure if the goal is the same, with all these different religions. Sometimes their goals are even defined differently. I mean, by the end, you have to really make a lot of clear distinctions. And a friend of mine, friend of ours, Reverend Hung Shu, he was working with a group of Catholics, and they were talking about really wanting to have ecumenical conversation. And they really found out there just some sticking words that they couldn't use, including God, that were just If Buddhists would use it and a Christian thinker, they're both different thinkers, and they would just have different meaning. So in this way, and especially if one, you know, says, oh, I want to do Buddhism, but I'm also interested in Christianity, I would recommend to go first of all deeply into one tradition so you actually know what you're talking about. In order to compare something, you have to know. So it's this general thing about, but everything goes to the same place. It's probably said because everything is happening in the same place. I think we all have an intuition of that. But ultimately we are talking about realizing it right now, and it's this life, and it takes a lot of effort and conditioning. So that's why I'm thinking, well, let's throw that effort and the work into one step first. And I'm saying for myself right now, that step is to really understand Buddhism very well. And once that step is done, I'm happy to look at other traditions. But, you know, sometimes it can be confusing if you start too early. Does it make sense?
Definitely. Yeah. It doesn't answer my question, though, and I'm not expecting you to answer my question.
Because you're having an interest, or what?
You know, what of those who sit in a cave? I'm just, you know, bringing up that it seems to me for some minds and for some beings, there's a path of study, and for others, maybe not. And they might reach the same state of awakening.
There is traditionally in Buddhism two paths, though the one path is a path of reasoning and the other path is a path of faith. And ultimately they say the path of reasoning on one point is transcended and then merges with the path of faith, which means there's only one path, which is the path of faith. So, does that answer your question? Yeah.
How has your study in Nepal changed your life and practice?
My life and practice?
Yes. That's probably a vast subject, but how have you been most affected by your time there? And how do you see yourself change now on your return, or is it too soon to ask?
Yeah, it's a little soon. Keep asking, though. But it definitely affected it. And interestingly, just to be clear about it, it was painful in many ways, and very challenging. And yet I'm like so amazed, just like the short time after having left the semester and finished my finals and, you know, went on. There are all these fruits coming out that I didn't even thought I planted. Especially because I had so resistance, you know, to everything. I was like, wow, oh my gosh. So, it's mysterious sometimes how it works. I'm still looking at it. I love to. I'm glad to be in community with you. I wanted to throw out some more thoughts and then ask you some questions too. So some of these, like, mind states that we have in our mind, and the five that are like the most hindering towards seeing emptiness directly, are seeking pleasure, having ill will, the belief in itself, and holding your practice as paramount, and doubting the path. And so I say it again. So pleasure seeking, like seeking for sense impressions, like really going for them, that kind of activity. Then ill will is kind of just like an aversion towards what you see. So both of them is like either leaning into your sense experience or leaning away from it. So this activity of leaning into and away from it is kind of a just very agitating activity that hinders you to see emptiness. And then, so talk about Mayana, emptiness, that's what I'm going to do now. And then the belief in a self, which is basically like taking your the five senses, the five aggregates, the five skandhas that we're chanting in the Heart Sutra in the morning, taking those to be the self, you know. So taking your thoughts to be yourself, taking your body to be yourself, taking your feelings to be something that you own, you appropriate, you think that's you, that they don't come at random or something. And then holding your practice paramount, or your discipline to be paramount, is basically like the thing of like, I'm in control of what's going on. I can like maneuver around, and whatever I do, gonna have a result. And it's true, there's gonna be a result, but to think that you, the practice, is gonna do the result, kind of maybe leading in what we're just talking about here, that I'm thinking, my study goes well, I'm going to have a good result. But then suddenly, like, my study doesn't go so well, I still have a good result, you know, it doesn't make any sense. But it's kind of going in this direction of, like, holding discipline to be paramount. It's like the idea that you're in control, basically, I would translate it like that. And it's leading to the mistake that... that you mistake the path. Like, for example, if you say, only sitting is the only thing that ever helps, you might have to look how much pride is involved, how much, it's a faith thing, you know? I mean, so that's kind of interesting. What's the difference between holding something to be paramount and holding and having really faith in something, you know, where is that sliding? Because one is maybe like holding the discipline to be paramount is maybe more reifying the cause and effect process. But I think having faith in this is like giving yourself to it. It's like two different qualities of how you give yourself to the same action. Maybe like that. And doubt is like a split mind. Doubt is like two minds. And then if you have doubt, then of course you're not settled because you have just two minds. So anyhow, if those are gone, you're seeing emptiness directly. So, yeah, and then maybe just briefly mention before we go into question and answer session that there are, I find it interesting that in this explanation of Abhidharma, there was also the notion, the explanation of how we have imputed, you know, afflictions and how we have innate ones. And I found that helpful because if something is self-created and fabricated, you know, of course it's going to fall apart. But if it's innate, then it's just very old and it has a momentum. And then it's just a matter of like waiting it out. That's what I came to my mind. And it's okay, you know. I think it was a cause for me to have much to compassion. Like, you know, whatever people do in this world, you know, either they're temporary, and they're either temporary confused, or they're just having like a real innate struggle that has to unfold itself. And but it's still going to pass because it's just rolling out, you know. Because the teaching is not saying that you're innately confused, because if that would be the case, then there wouldn't be no point to practice, right? So it's just saying there's just some innate momentum with whatever past actions we had, that that momentum is just has sometimes has needs the time. So the imputed is maybe like the momentary the moment of confusion, and the innate one is like the inertia of the action, kind of thing. So, you have questions right now?
You said that Ajahn are the teachings of the Buddha, mm-hmm. Is that right? So there's a story that there Ajahn is the teachings of Buddha.
That's a story, it's true.
Do you believe that story, or is it helpful to think of the story as
true? Well, if you say the Buddha was an awakened person who saw the reality, then I think I believe the story that somebody who came up with this kind of vision was pretty awakened to what's going on in the world.
Yes.
However, if that person was called to dinner by Shakyamuni or by Gerd or by Rosie, you know, I really don't care, because that's just another name. So if that was the same person or multiple persons, they had a certain awakened state, you know, like to say that the teachings came out of a place of clear seeing. And still, the Abhidharma is like the like problem. Like, there wouldn't be, like, all the other philosophical schools are basically the commentary to the Abhidharma, because it has so many mistakes in it, and it's, like, logically so incoherent that all the other people who are also awakened beings in the later philosophical schools had to try to fix it all the time, you know? And still, at the same time, basis, you know, it's a great basis. I mean, it was like, there it was, Shakyamuni Buddha walking around talking to people, and people were like, let's try to figure out what he said, and trying to structure it, and, you know, compiling it, and making lists, like
figure out what Buddha said? Trying
to structure it and present it, you know.
The Abhidharma.
The Abhidharma is that result of the, you know, like the sutras are like the narratives. He was Buddha. I heard the Buddha was there at such and such a time. And then the Abhidharma is like, well, in so many sutras he said these kinds of lists, and in so many sutras it's these kind of lists. We actually don't know why they contradict each other, but maybe they have to do with this kind of presentation, and all these philosophical schools come up out of. But those people were sure awakened, because they kind of knew what he was talking about. So
the people who studied the Abhidharma initially
and put it together and then studied it, and yeah, I think they were pretty smart people. Yeah, you like the Abhidharma? No, you don't. What you don't like about it?
I am not at all inspired by all those lists. I see the lists and I kind of just go dull and turn into something else. Which I might be seeking sense pleasures, and that's not pleasurable, but I see it as something that some people found deeply meaningful and worked very hard to put together. And then we had a young monk who said no to all of it, and that's what we chant every morning.
So I'm with him.
Yeah.
What's that?
Nagarjuna. No, the unnamed monk who wrote the Heart Sutra. Nagarjuna meaning someone who didn't like the Abhidharma. I just wondered
when you said the Buddha.
Yeah.
Then I, you know, get a little excited when I hear something like that.
Yeah. Words make us excited, it's true. Yeah, the no teachings are very powerful, and at the same time, it's good to know where they're based on because they're kind of related.
Yes.
So you got to know what you're saying no about. So I wanted to ask you the question, and I'm going to call on you too, and don't mind me forgetting your name maybe, because tonight even my own name sounds strange to me, pure guessing. So what's your highest priority in your life?
Who are you calling
out? You!
Life.
Yeah, the highest, the top one.
If I could arrive at a place that was relatively peaceful and at ease, and was able to be spontaneous in its response to the world, and do what we call or respond in what we would call skillful ways to situations, that would be my priority. I think that would solve all the things I want to do in my life.
A place of skillful response and...
Skillful means. Coming from what we call emptiness, but I don't call emptiness. Emptiness means nothing to me.
Yeah.
But in every sense.
Yeah.
I've said this before. I understand the idea of it in terms of no self, and I accept that.
Yeah.
But as a background, it's not something to be thought and spent time with because it's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Literally nonsense. But if I would repeat it, I would say, to find a place of ease of mind, of peace of mind, of equanimity that I don't have. This is not something I have. This is what I like.
Okay.
This is what I practice with in mind. And from that, I would hope to have a life that responded, where I could respond spontaneously and naturally to things as they arose. And I can have skill. I'm be doing it in a skillful way. That would be the most helpful, and probably help people maybe suffer a little less.
Thank you. I want to ask to other people too, but just as a side note, I heard recently that in one of my classes that skillful means comes out of shamatha. So because you said it comes out of emptiness, it actually comes from shamatha. So the more you calm your mind and let go of your thoughts, the more creative you are.
That's my point.
Here you go.
Just
concentrate on that and just let everything aside. Corinne, what's the most priority for you?
Well, it's not different from what
Richard said.
To be awake in the moment by moment.
Yeah.
And to be able to respond. To be able to see in the moment what is actually happening, and to be able to respond accurately and spontaneously.
Okay.
Coming from compassion, which of course involves the seeing and the willingness to act.
Okay. Brian?
Actually, these are great responses, I have to say. I have a question for you about Tibetan Buddhism.
Okay.
Is there different schools?
Yeah, many.
And what is the kind of different emphasis in those schools, what differentiates them?
I think differentiate them if the practices. I think they're mostly different practice lineages. They're like, some people set priority on meditation, and some people set priority on tantric ritual, some set priority on and then also the deities, you know, there's a lot of tantric practices for deities, lineage fathers, you know, just like the Zen and Rinzai, kind of different like that.
Right. Buddhism come to Tibet in a particular way? Was there a person that brought it to Tibet?
Many people.
So it sort of, all these different people showed up and started practicing Buddhism.
Yeah. But what is your priority in your life?
I'm sorry?
What's your priority in your life? The highest one.
It's a question I really can't answer. I like Richard's response a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, okay, that. And then somebody else will say something. I said, oh, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
So I end up saying, I don't know.
Yeah. It's sweet of you guys. Is there anybody else who is saying, wants to say, highest priority for you? Just shout it out. I mean, there's no wrong answer, right? It's just a check-in. And it's kind of interesting because I think, and in this way, I find that's an important question, because we are acting in our daily life according to what our priorities are. So it is kind of forming our activity in our day all the time. And so do you have a question for me? Not, I have another question for you. So, do you believe in cause and effect?
Could you repeat?
Do you believe in cause and effect? In cause and effect?
Oh, cause
and effect. Yeah. Now
that's a big mainstay of teaching.
It's right in there, yeah.
Cause and effect.
Right there. Yeah, and yet, you know, like, one of the 10 main disturbing emotions, one of the 10 is to not believe in cause and effect. It's pretty disturbing. Because then all these consequences come out of it where you negate or neglect your actions. Why, huh? So yeah, do you believe in cause and effect?
I like the term of radical belief in cause and effect. Absolutely everything, with no exception, has a cause and an effect, and the impact it has on me is to be very aware of everything I'm doing, just everything, not in a fearful way, but just in a isn't this interesting that no matter how I do any single thing, even just moving my hand, there's some effect, maybe negligible in the scheme of things, but there's no exceptions to that. No exceptions to that.
No exceptions, that's right, yeah. Yeah, and I heard these stories about, you know, how the Buddha Shakyamuni had disciples that are very psychic, and that even they, with the psychic eye, were actually limited to what the Buddha saw. Like, it's actually the Buddha who can see all these consequences often action. And so even psychic power, with the story of this, can't completely reveal. It's really just the omniscience of Buddhahood that can completely, you know, unfold why everything is happening the way it's happening. And that's fascinating, you know, because then, like you're saying, radical, it is absolutely radical. It's like, there doesn't seem to be a gap. Even with the, you know, what we, because we just don't know, you know, say, oh, must be coincidence or something, you know. No, cause and effect right there. It's beautiful.
And even within that, sometimes people, you know, might feel that that's fatalistic or something. Somehow still there's just this fresh moment that we're in, even though we are a product of everything that's happened before, still we can just do something fresh right now that appears to have no... It appears very spontaneous.
Yeah.
And I don't know what exactly it is, but I like that there's the two aspects there.
Yeah.
All of the unknowable causes and conditions that no one could ever possibly track, or but they exist, and just this fresh moment.
Yeah. Because by the end of the day, meaning if there's an awakened state of mind, it's not conditioned, right? Though with awakened eyes, you watch cause and effect, but you're not involved. You're just really aware. And though that is that freedom then of not being chased around. And of course we don't know what it is, because there's just so many. But if we keep identifying as the conditions, then we don't see how awareness is never altered a moment. It's just moment to moment, just aware. There's no cause or condition. I mean, yeah. Questions? Do you have questions?
Seems like what's coming to mind for me right now is being really present, being available to trust that you still yourself enough and you're really aware.
If you want to do it,
you still yourself,
still yourself.
Really quiet and calm inside.
Mm-hmm.
And be sometimes not very
much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then be aware, but then trust that things will work out for the best for all. If you make our best heartfelt efforts to be like an instrument of peace in that, but trusting that that can happen if we're open and quiet and calm and aware in that way.
Right. The only hook I see here, may I say so?
Yeah.
What I see the hook is. We have the tendency to be confused about what to adopt and what to reject, you know. That's like the basic definition of like which actions to follow, which impulses to follow and which impulses to let go of, for example. And to say, yeah, to like let go of all impulses, that's shamatha and it's beautiful. But most of the day, when we go through the day, you gotta follow some impulses if you go around your business. And then it's kind of hard to say which impulses to follow and which impulses not to follow. And so in order to really know then what to do, if you're not in a state of shamatha,
studying today, and I shared with the students my favorite number 13 from the Dada Chain. Do you have the patience to wait until your mind settles and an appropriate action arises by itself? That's what I keep coming back to, and really trusting that appropriate response will arise if I wait long enough. Sometimes I don't have enough time, and I do have to make a decision, and I'm still not sure. But sort of using that as a paradigm. Being still and waiting and then responding accordingly and as appropriately as I can.
I like that.
Something like that.
Thank you. Richard.
That's our study, our practice period topic. This period, this is Sankan's poem, Trust in Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he put it very well, what he just said, that that's what trust in mind is. If you trust nature, if you mm-hmm. empty it enough, that you just have faith that
mm-hmm.
what will follow will, mm-hmm. will work, will be okay.
Now that leads to the question that I'm really curious and I need to learn. What is faith? Like, what kind of faith are we talking about? What are you saying?
I think that goes along with that trust, because I remember when I started my practice, the two elements that seem so contradictory in Zen are having great faith and great doubt at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to somehow bring those two together and work with them.
Hmm. Yes.
I'm coming back quickly because I wanted to address that. Now he just did, and I think doubt for me can be misunderstood. I think in my interpretation, mm-hmm. there's a positive doubt, which is questioning,
mm-hmm.
and there's a negative kind of doubt, which is self-demeaning. It means I don't deserve, or I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant for me, I'm not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of doubt is destructive. I think another word should be used, probably other than doubt, for the positive
mm-hmm.
idea, which means don't ever just take things that are given to you as
mm-hmm.
true.
Mm-hmm.
You need to find for yourself your truth.
Mm-hmm.
But so doubt is a charged word.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a positive way of taking it in the negative way.
Well, it's interesting because, so here we are in this, you know, society that's produced a lot of low self-esteem in people.
Well, exactly.
We do that to each other, yeah. And so, and to ourselves. And I think then doubt is mostly understood as the opposite of confidence.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting though, because, you know, to have confidence in the teachings would be an ultimate goal. I don't know where you want to place doubt next to it, you know, again, like with these teachings of what you're also just saying, you know, there's just, it's kind of funny in Zen, because Zen really likes to, like, be very in the present moment and de-emphasizing a path. But even in a moment, you have, maybe in two moments, you have different levels of consciousness or of your actions. And then, you know, like, all these teachings, like I said earlier, they're for the dull and for the medium and for the sharp. Like I said, they're like, our mind changes and has different, you know, blind spots. And so one teaching is for the one spot and the other teaching is for another. And then the idea of the path that we develop towards Buddhahood is just that same thought. You know, and in Zen we kind of like de-emphasize that because there's this whole thing about it's right here. But it doesn't diminish the fact that it's right here. It's I think the idea of path is like really emphasizing the fact that that our mind needs work. It's like causes and conditions, you know. And having causes and conditions unfolding, trusting that. Patrick.
Well, I like the word confidence. I think I came here to really get a good idea about the great matter, because I thought that Buddhism, you know, this was just an all an idea. I didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. You know, something to hold on to. Mm-hmm. And but actually, with you know, a variety of good teachers, you know, Catherine being the one that I studied with the most, I've been given confidence to sort of be a little more flexible, to let go of what I would usually think of as a fixed idea of understanding. And especially, you know, getting in when I'm in a tight spot and I really feel like I have to have an idea, if I can be mindful and just say, okay, let that one go and see if I can hear something else in this conversation. I've got a little more confidence that I can let go and not try to hold on to or put together something fixed. So I have a little more confidence that that's how I should move forward. The actions that I should take in that situation. So that's where I come down on faith.
You got a result, yeah. I'm just seeing I'm over time. Sorry to hold you. Maybe we can keep talking outside. I'm not sure if I should make an attempt to sum it up because it hasn't been a sum from the start, right? But I think all of what you have been studying over the time of bodhicitta and the cause and effect works very well together with this whole teaching setup that we encounter that it's just really pointing at our mind, and it's really just like saying, you know, here can be practice can be done right here, that's the ground. And then the cause and conditions coming together is a path, and there is fruition. And the fruition is in a vacant state of mind. And so for us to like assume that there's in a vacant state is a good thing, but to stay we know what that is, you know, is maybe a little presumptuous. But we hear from other beings who have been there about the quality, so that's helpful. And sometimes, you know, like my experience with all of this and how people keep asking me about like, so what's about Tibetan Buddhism and what, you know, what's going on here. Like part of me, you know, had this experience that like it's one thing to stand at the bay and look at the bay of San Francisco, and you can look at it from different sides, you can even fly over or look at the map, but it's not the ocean, you know? If you look at the ocean, it's different. It's a different effect on the mind too. If you look at the bay, look at the ocean, it's different. So sometimes, you know, I find that it's easy to put Buddhahood into our definition of bay, you know, into a set of, you know, explanations. But Buddhahood is not what Buddha is, you know. We make statues of Buddha, you know, write the name, we do all kinds of things. But the ocean is, you know, what is there to say, you know? So, with that in mind, I'm hoping and wish that we can support each other, because especially like with teachings that are difficult, you know, like the Abhidharma teaching, some other teaching, and especially if you don't see a sense of them on the first sight, you know, it might be hard to stay open to the ocean, and then we just tend towards the bay. You know, give me the easy explanation. And so it's actually not a one person. Like, I'm like a person, like, I alone, I'm too lazy. I just don't do things without pressure. So, and that, the Sangha, as that's why I think Sangha is put into the three jewels, because it's a prime cause and condition for Buddhahood. To be in company with each other, to help listening. Listening is a prime cause, to help thinking. So these are the prime causes and conditions for this state. And so that's why it's very precious to be together and to do this endeavor of Buddha study, Buddha awakening study. And we continue. Yeah. Being sad, numberless, I